Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 29th of July 1923, peace with Turkey, disarmament, the president abroad, the Bank of England expands, schoolboys and gambling, and Nigerians and booze. But first, the headlines. The Treaty of Lausanne between Turkey and the Allies has been signed, more of which later. The dock strike continues. I should point out that this is a London-only dock strike. There has been some sort of decision about the government of Kenya. This is doubtlessly related to the Indian delegation I mentioned in the 25th of March, 6th of May and 10th of June episodes, but I haven't had the time to dig into it. Suffice to say, the Indians are not happy. A fortnight ago, the mark reached £1 million to the pound. This week it reached £5 million to the pound. Berlin is running short of food, and in Breslau, rioting and looting have resulted in 6 deaths. In other news, there has been an ongoing debate on air defence and especially the respective roles of the Royal Air Force and Royal Navy Aviation. There is an ongoing correspondence on the subject of privately owned German property in England. Essentially, after the Versailles Treaty, it was swiped by the government, and any inquiries about compensation were forwarded to the German government. There is another ongoing correspondence on the subject of the Bank of England. Essentially, the bank doesn't think its current Sir John Soane designed and much-loved headquarters is sufficient and is proposing to build a second story on top of it. Well, I say a second story, it's a sort of several stories on top of it, actually. Why exactly the Bank of England needs all this extra space when, since the closure of the gold window in 1914, it has less to do is unclear. No one seems to have taken up my suggestion that the building and institution it houses should literally and figuratively be razed to the ground. The government has announced that it will be spending a lot of money on airship development because that is the future. Government's wasting money by picking winners in transport. Couldn't happen today. There has been quite the reaction to the letter from Admiral Percy Scott that I referred to in last week's episode. Unfortunately, time prevents me from going into any detail on that one. An inquiry into a betting tax has heard evidence that many schoolboys gamble. You know, it is remarkable how much more freedom teenagers had in those days. I mean, they could gamble, they could drink, they could work. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I suspect it's a good thing, but who knows? Anyway, a man has been fined for dealing in raw opium, despite the fact that at no point was the opium in question in the United Kingdom. At Wembley Stadium, a team representing Oxford and Cambridge universities has beaten a team representing Harvard and Yale universities. A chap called Harold Abrahams did very well. A place he might not have done so well in, or at least not have been so welcome, was the 13th Pan-German Athletic Meeting in Munich. Visitors were greeted at the station by Hitler's supporters, claiming that they were there in the interests of law and order. While making his escape from a bank robbery, the accused in a murder trial fired at a bystander. The bystander later died, but it was discovered that the bullet that killed him could not have come from the accused's gun. Not that this did him any good. The court took the view that he was acting in common purpose with his accomplice and convicted him of murder. While visiting Liverpool, one of the horses of the Duke of York's procession panicked, injuring 13 onlookers. In an indication that things are returning to normal, the Irish government has announced a general election. President Harding of America has made a speech in Vancouver, British Columbia, making him only the second serving president to set foot on foreign soil. The first president to set foot on foreign soil was his predecessor, Woodrow Wilson, who, on his return, proceeded to suffer a stroke. Ominous. One place that Harding is unlikely to visit is the Soviet Union, as the two countries don't have diplomatic relations, and nor are they likely to, as the US Secretary of State made clear this week, citing the Bolshevist belief in world revolution. There is an ongoing correspondence over the question of the importation of spirits to Nigeria. Some claim that Nigerians are getting drunk. Others are claiming that Nigerians are perfectly capable of producing their own alcohol, usually from palm trees. In Signs of the Times, a foreigner living in the United Kingdom has been heavily fined for failing to register a change of address. There has been some criticism of the post office for continually digging up the road, which is odd because they don't tend to do that nowadays, and which is a sign of the time, of course. And they're having complaints about people flying streamers from the backs of charabancs. If you don't know what a charabanc is, it is a early form of coach. After the First World War, the Allies and the Ottoman Empire signed the Treaty of Sèvres. Turks, led by Mustafa Kemal, rejected this and won the subsequent war. With the old treaty a dead letter, a new treaty is required. As mentioned, this new treaty, the Treaty of Lausanne, has just been signed. This has been marked with an editorial in the Times. This is from Wednesday, the 25th of July. The Lausanne conference came to an end yesterday with the signature of peace. To those who have followed the proceedings of the conference since it first met last November, proceedings which have been one long series of delays, deadlocks, and disappointments, the news, with all that it implies, will bring a sense of profound relief. This does not mean that all parties will be equally satisfied. To the Turks, indeed, the completeness of their victory may well seem incredible. There is little enough resemblance between their position today and that in which they found themselves under the terms of the Armistice of Mudros, that's the armistice, the end of the war, or the Treaty of Sèvres, and still less between their position today and that of October 1914. Well, indeed, they had an empire in those days. It goes on. In the course of the protracted negotiations, the Allies have carried their conciliatoriness to an unprecedented extreme. Nor have the Turks failed to take advantage of the situation in which the peace was negotiated. They had every reason to believe that the Allies desired peace at almost any cost. They knew that the united front opposed to them often partook rather of the nature of an echelon formation than of a straight line. I'm not quite sure what they mean there, but it tends to indicate weakness of some description. It goes on. They were aware of the complications arising not only from the other preoccupations of Europe, but from the pressure of financial interests. And just as it is creditable to the Allied representatives that in spite of these complications, they persisted in the performance of the duty entrusted to them, so the Turks may be congratulated on the tenacity with which they conducted the bargaining. Even when the outlook at Lausanne has been blackest, the uprightness and ability of Ismet Pasha have never lacked recognition by the Allies. Essentially, the Allies were divided amongst themselves. I mean, the British Empire was divided amongst itself. And the Allies really, really didn't want a war, which meant that the Turks were in a very, very strong position. It goes on. Are we to believe that because the treaty has been negotiated as between equals, Turkey has become by some miracle a civilized power? My goodness, that's a strong statement. Often enough at Lausanne, it was clear that the hitches which arose were due not to bad faith on the part of the Turkish delegates, but to their sheer ignorance of the rules of the game. Their suspicion of even the plainest and most obvious suggestion, lest it should conceal some trick, while a natural instinct to people for whom negotiation means the haggling of the bazaar, revealed the gulf which exists between their mentality and that of Western Europe. You would have thought that this would satisfy anyone, but no. There was a debate on disarmament in the House of Commons. This is from Tuesday, the 24th of July. Here are some extracts. James Ramsay MacDonald, the Labour leader, said that it must be a subject of the most profound regret in all parts of the House that today the expenditure on preparations for the next war had mounted up to such colossal figures. Leading politicians in 1914 and 1915 said that they were asking the nation to enlist in a war to end war. It is amazing how quickly that phrase has ceased to be credible. The newspapers were melancholy, heartbreaking reading, with their talk about air competition and the necessity of spending more money for defence. Bizarrely, a lot of people are worried about the size of the French Air Force. The next war would be worse than ever. There would be the blockade, and what was more, the air raids with poison gases, which would simply devastate whole towns and countrysides. By blockade, he means the Battle of the Atlantic or the U-boat campaign. I give him 3 out of 6 here. Blockade, air raids and urban devastation, yes. Poison gas, rural devastation and worse than the First World War, no. Well, in Britain's case, I mean, actually Britain got rather lucky. It was one of the very few countries for which the Second World War was not as bad as the First. Anyway, he goes on. The end of it all was to create one great military hegemony. The small nations would be placed in servitude either as allies or as enemies, and in the end, on account of the massing of material, the massing of brains, and the organisation of national power, the result would be that one nation would dominate, with perhaps a smaller group of nations nearly as powerful disputing its domination. This seems awfully confused. If there is to be a hegemon, there cannot be a dispute. Of course, when he describes smaller nations being put into servitude, he is quite right when he refers to Eastern Europe. Western Europe, not so much. He goes on. They, the government, had to make up their minds that there was absolutely no national security in military expenditure. By trusting to military expenditure alone, we were dooming ourselves to ultimate destruction. I'll allow the audience to make up their minds if he was right or hopelessly, hopelessly wrong. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.